Making a recipe that calls for butter? Make it better with European butter from France. With a minimum of 82% butter fat, it's no wonder French butter is the number one choice of chefs the world over. Whether you're whipping up an omelet, sauteing vegetables, or spreading it on toast, the rich, cultured flavor of butter from France always elevates. Be sure to look for Made in France on the label. And for recipes, tips, and tricks, go to tasteeurope.com.
Working in restaurants for years, like, every chef is obsessed with mortadella. Like, and no customers are, but the chefs are. And then you go to Italy, and obviously it's a really important product. It's just like the flavor of a really good mortadella, the texture of a really good mortadella is, like, you know, just so satisfying.
You're listening to The Taste Podcast. I'm senior editor Anna Huesel, and I'm here with editor-in-chief Matt Rodbard.
Today on the show, we have Mike Fadem and Marie Tribouillard, who are the owners behind the restaurant Ops in Bushwick. Later in the show, I'll be talking to the folks from Yes Please, an extremely cool coffee subscription service. But Anna, tell me about Ops.
I love going to Ops. Ops is one of those rare restaurants that has a really concise menu. There are only, like, I don't know, maybe 10 items. They really stick to what they're good at. They do a handful of pizzas every night, and they always have one or two of what Marie likes to call room temperature vegetables. That's kind of her specialty.
What a nice way to talk about vegetables. Like, room temp is the best temp for veg. But also, they were nominated for a James Beard Award, right?
Yeah, the morning that we talked, they had just been nominated for a James Beard Award for their wine program. They have really cool wines. Mike and Marie picked them all. They're totally unpretentious about it. If you go in and just ask for a glass of wine, you don't have to really know what you're doing. They'll pick a few and you can try them, and they'll help you find something that you like. I also love that they have a really cool selection of Amaros, which is always a good way to end an Italian
meal. Washes down that pizza really nicely.
It does.
Here's Anna with Mike and Marie.
Welcome to the Taste Podcast, Mike and Marie.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
You together run Ops in Bushwick. It's a pizza place. How did the two of you come to collaborate, and how did you start working together?
Well, we worked together for a while at a restaurant called Romans in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, part of a group that I worked for about 7 years, and Marie for four or so.
Yeah.
So we worked there together, and then working there together, we became friends, and she left to work at a different restaurant in the company. And kind of when this opportunity came up, she was the first person I thought of, and we just started, like, brainstorming, and then just started working all day, every day for the rest of our lives.
Wow. when you made the decision to open Ops, were there some kind of, like, base non-negotiables that the two of you knew you wanted to have on the menu? Pizza, obviously. But what else? Were there kind of staples that you used as starting points?
In terms of food or everything?
Yeah, everything.
I think the wine was also really a priority. We wanted to be a nice, simple, high-quality, high wine bar with very good pizza. And then when we were trying to figure out what else was going to go on a menu, we were like, well, we really like vegetables, and there's not that many places where we can eat some. And if we're going to, you know, stuff people's bellies with cheese and dough, it makes sense to have something a little lighter on the side. And we're pretty limited there in terms of equipment. So it was actually perfect for us to do something that's very, like, Italian peasants food, small antipasti plate, pretty much all vegetarian or vegan. Those were the priorities, I think, were, like, the wine and some simple vegetable food to go with the pizza.
Mm-hmm.
We're also sitting here right now on a Wednesday afternoon, and it happens to be the day that the James Beard semifinalists were announced. Mm-hmm. And Ops was nominated for Outstanding Wine Program. How do you feel about that?
we feel really weird about it. It's great. We feel really honored. And that was never even remotely on our list of possible achievements. So
definitely not.
It's great. I don't know.
Who manages the wine program for Ops? Is it the two of you, or do you have someone else who makes selections?
Yeah, I do most of that.
Yeah, well, he's the exceptional wine program person.
Wow, congratulations.
Yes.
I have to ask how you came to choose Bushwick for Ops.
Well, so in the time of me like doing all this testing and working on the pizza and kind of making this whole idea in my head, my good friend who I used to work for is this guy Gavin, who owns Variety Coffee Roasters, which is has become quite a successful little coffee company in New York City. And they started in Williamsburg, and I worked for him before I worked for the restaurants, and we've just been friends ever since. And he was offered the space right next to one of his locations in Bushwick, and he called me and was like, "Do you want to do your thing there? You know, I know you've been working on this project, and let's do it together." So it wasn't. I definitely had been out there a lot and really loved the location and loved the community that was bustling and growing there, and thought it was like a cool place to like start something that, you know, the community might actually want it there because there wasn't really much else to offer. So it just made perfect sense. The space was perfect. Everything was, was
there. Do you have a lot of regulars just from the immediate neighborhood, or are a lot of people coming in from the city?
So many regulars.
So many, neighborhood people.
I guess now the proportion is changing a little bit because we've been gaining some attention for people. And again, because as you said, pizza is very important for New Yorkers. People travel to eat it, but I think most of our clientele is coming from that neighborhood, yeah.
So you weren't too worried about the L train shutting down?
Not really, no, because if anything, the L train would have been running in Brooklyn still.
Right.
So it would have kept people in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that travel to get there do it in a cab anyway, because it's not that convenient to that many neighborhoods. That's one. I mean, a lot of people complain to me all the time, like, "Oh, I'd be there so often if it was a little more convenient to Cobble Hill or a little more convenient to this neighborhood or whatever."
Yeah, unless you live off the M or the L, which is great. It's already serving a lot of people.
Yeah.
But a lot of people take cars.
It's kind of nice that it's a little hard to get to, though, because I feel like every time I go to Ops, I don't have to wait too long for a table. It's not the same kind of like pilgrimage where you're going to a pizza place and waiting 3 hours to sit down.
Right. And it's small. So if it was like the same size and somewhere more convenient, it would probably be a big problem.
It would be terrible.
Yeah.
Or, so you guys, or people wouldn't care maybe if it was any more. Maybe people like that it's so hard to get there.
I don't know.
Yeah. You're not on the verge of moving to lower Manhattan.
Thank God. No,
no,
please,
that's not going to happen.
Please, no.
No,
please,
we love our regulars and our neighbors there. Yeah.
One of my favorite things on the menu at Ops is the mortadella pizza. I think it's the Rojo, right? With pickled peppers and mortadella. Yeah. It's so great. I think before like a year or so ago, I had probably never had mortadella. And now it seems like it's on every single restaurant menu.
Yeah.
Why is that? Why is mortadella such a big thing now?
It's a funny thing that, like, working in restaurants for years, like, every chef is obsessed with mortadella. Like, and no customers are, but the chefs are, and then you go to Italy, and obviously it's a really important product. It's just, like, the flavor of a really good mortadella, the texture of a really good mortadella is, like, you know, just so satisfying, I think.
It's a little, like, bologna.
Yeah, like bologna comes from it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, where
it's like an elevated bologna, I guess.
And yeah, mortadella comes from like near Bologna, and Bologna is the same word as bologna. So
there's definitely a correlation.
Yeah, there's got to be some kind of correlation there. And it's supposedly it's also like an extremely hard thing to make perfectly. Like it's like the greatest butchers and charcuterie makers like are like heralded for their like mortadellas and like the size and how perfect the texture is and everything. So I think it's something that's just really respected in the food community in the world, in that world. And I think the more like bigger restaurants are willing to like make something with mortadella be like a feature, it's becoming more, people are realizing it's like, it's just like any kind of charcuterie. It doesn't have to be like a bad thing.
Where's the best place to get mortadella, like as a as an ingredient? Are there makers in New York, or do you pretty much have to source it from Italy?
Yeah, we get it from a really amazing producer in Chicago called, I think they changed their name a little slightly.
Tempesta
Artisans or something like that.
Yeah.
They make our pepperoni, and they also make the mortadella. It's definitely the best mortadella I've ever tasted that's not made in Italy. They're really good at making products that really taste like they do in Italy, as opposed to like a lot of American products. They try to like do a little spin or a riff or something, which is awesome. But with something like mortadella, we tried so many different ones, and this one was just so much better than everybody else's that we went with that. Yeah.
I love how the warmth of the pizza kind of like gives the mortadella a not really like cooked or melted flavor.
It melted a little bit.
Yeah,
it makes it a little loose.
Softer, more buttery texture.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely was, the idea was to make it kind of like a sandwich feeling of eating it, but really to also be pizza and like hit all the other things you want a pizza to have. So, yeah.
Have you done any other experiments with mortadella or used it in any other cooking?
We've done some we like to like chop it up and fry it, kind of like, you know, like fried bologna, or, you know, I grew up as a kid, my mom would always make me fried bologna sandwiches, and it was like the best thing I'd ever had. But so we fry it and put it into a calzone, which is really cool too. It like gives you like the texture and that flavor, and yeah, that works well.
It's delicious. We definitely snack on it a lot.
Yeah, just snacking on pieces of fried.
Just putting it on anything, really.
I love that.
It's good with everything. Yeah.
It is, yeah. It's got the crunch from the pistachios, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another ingredient I have to ask you about is Amaro, because in addition to having an amazing wine list, you guys have a pretty sick collection of Amaros.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes in your chocolate cake. It goes in a beer cocktail with Budweiser, which I've had before. Why do you like Amaro so much as an ingredient, as, you know, a set of flavors, and even as a ritual?
Well, I think we both like bitter things in general, and for different reasons. I think that Mike has spent a lot of time in Italy, and I grew up in France, and I grew up like right by where chartreuse is made. So we both have a sensibility to regional bitter booze. I really miss that kind of flavor, because in France it's not, I mean, now it's coming back a little bit, but it took me to live in New York City to actually rediscover those flavors. And I think it's wonderful that these distilleries are being represented here. It's a whole range of really interesting flavor profiles that we don't really know about. And it gained popularity, obviously. There's now a lot of really great Amaros in a lot of bars and restaurants in New York. So we were interested in maybe offering something a little different, trying to find like smaller distilleries. We also work with a lot of wine importers who sometimes have like a few Amaros on their portfolios, as opposed to working with like one big liquor importer who like has all of the major ones. So it was great for us to have access to a lot of, you know, maybe like smaller batches and smaller quantities Amaros. Yeah, and we're always very, very interested in tasting all of them. So
which one do you use in the chocolate cake that you make?
That one is Chiocero, yeah, which I think is really, it's the one that's the most balanced for cooking. It holds really well. It's a flourless chocolate cake, so you need to have a pretty strong emulsion. And this one was the one that like gave a little bit of flavor. It's not too bitter. It's not too strange. Because if you start using all of that like fernetty, like really minty stuff in cooking, it can get a little too intense.
Mm-hmm.
But that one was really balanced. That's the one we're also using in the Budweiser.
Where did that idea come from?
That's a French thing.
Is it?
So in France, we don't have a Moro per se, but we have something that's called Picon. That's a bitter orange liqueur or, you know, booze. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, we used to serve it. This, I'm talking like my grandparents and my parents' generation. But we mix it with beer, with like cheap light beer on draft or with white wine. And a picon bière was really like a blue collar thing or something that we, you know, like my when we were able to like order alcohol in bars, my male friends would always get it because it would get you drunk a little faster. And
oh, so just it was a tiny bit faster. Than...
it's actually really efficient. If you drink two, you're gonna be more than tipsy.
It's a whole shot of the bitter.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. And depending on the bars in France, they definitely like put more or less, you know, it's a whole thing. So it just made sense to me. It was nice. We really wanted to have Budweiser as like, you know, it's the king of beers.
Yeah.
And we had the Amaro, and it's nice to make it a little better too. You know, you make it kind of like a slightly sweet, slightly nutty.
Yeah. It's like adding flavor to something without that much flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
So yeah, French blue collar tradition.
I love that. What's next for the two of you? Are there any projects that you really want to work on at Ops or menu items that you want to experiment with?
Well, I just opened a little wine store, so that's going to be like what I'm going to do parallel to Ops.
What is it called?
It's called Forêt. It means forest. It's in Ridgewood. It's right by my house. So it's a very small project, but I feel like it is in the continuity of what we're doing in at Ops.
Are you working
same
with a lot of
importers? Okay. Same wines, not same wines, but same importers and same, you know, natural wine philosophy. There is an overlap of our customers too, for sure. So it's been nice to have that kind of community in both places. And I think we also really just want to make sure our restaurant is sustainable and successful in a way that's not just financial. I think that having this like great family of staff members growing with us has been really important, and making it a long-term project that is like thriving and always adapting. And yeah, I think it takes actually a lot of time. What would you say?
Very well said.
Do you want to open 5 more locations?
Yeah, are you guys going to be the new Roberta's, like,
nope,
opening up across
that's
the country?
That's definitely not going to happen.
Never going to happen.
No. Nope. Yep. No, we're saying it's on the record now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is not going to happen.
We feel good about saying it. No, it's taking a lot of work just to have one.
Yeah, and we're like, I feel like so thrilled that we've been as successful as we have been yet so far. The location, space we have, so just trying to keep it good.
Yeah, just trying to keep it good.
I love that. Thank you both so much for coming onto the Taste
Thank
Podcast.
Thank you so much
Thank
for, having,
for
us.
Having us.
Here's Matt with coffee subscription service and zine Yes Please.
Tony Tongs, Kinesny, and Sumi Ali, welcome to the Taste Podcast.
Thanks. Really good to be here.
Yeah, thank you for finally having us.
Yeah, I met you collectively on Instagram because I subscribed to Yes Please, and I was like, holy shit, this is my favorite thing. And then we started talking.
You're an early adopter.
Oh, really? Is that
yeah.
Considered?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you signed up in December, like right when we launched.
I got to say, like, I think I found out about it from the LA Times article, which was a cool little thing.
Yeah, that came out of nowhere for us. We haven't really done any press or PR yet.
Yeah.
But I think Peter Meehan follows Sumi on Instagram and caught wind of it. And
yeah, it was one of those moments where I just saw Grease Trap liked 2 or 3 of my photos, and I was...
Yeah,
it's like I know who that is, and it was like, oh shit, I don't know what's gonna happen.
No, he's doing his job out here. It seems like LA Times is really looking good.
Yeah,
so we are in LA, and we are at the end of your weekly cycle. We'll get into exactly what Yes Please is, because it's a really innovative concept. But honestly, I want to get started and just like find out straight up the name Yes Please. Where does that come from?
Oh, man. Okay. So it was a few years ago. It was right after I sold my previous startup, Tonks, to Blue Bottle. Frankly, I was really high out of my mind and just kind of saw the name appear, like spelled exactly like that, in a vision. And I grabbed my phone and I pulled out a yellow pencil in the notes app, and I drew something that's not too far from the logo we have now. And I just put it in my back pocket and thought, if I'm ever crazy enough to do a business like this again, which was definitely not the headspace I was in after Tonks, that this would be a great brand name, and just kind of threw it in the
edible. Was this a big ass joint? A blunt?
It was a combination of things that maybe don't get talked about on this podcast. that might be for a different podcast.
Okay, well,
it was a journey.
It was a journey. Okay, but so we've set up Yes Please this name, but really, Sumi, tell me, what exactly are you doing? And we were talking before with taping. You're like, this was maybe not the best idea.
Yeah, we're crazy and insane, and yeah, I think this kind of came from, we were in a position where we're sick of drinking the coffee that was available to us, so we figured we should start roasting coffee again and maybe put it in people's mailboxes again. And you know, that came from Tony and I working together in the past. I worked for his old company, Tonks, and so we knew we wanted to have some sort of editorial. I mean, I'll let Tony expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think with my previous subscription coffee company, Tonks, we put a letter in every box, and there was kind of very high touch, but it was always meant to kind of become more than that, to sort of have like a newsletter or a zine. And so it was a vague idea, and we didn't really know kind of how big the shovel was that we were about to right. start digging a hole with. And I think, you know, Sumi and I had worked together on the project of doing coffee for Roy Choi, Daniel Patterson's.
I'd like to get into that. We can get into that later. Yeah,
sure. And so I think it just felt like this was the natural next thing to do, but to do it in a way that was like small and intimate and bootstrapped.
Yeah. So we're talking about not just like the weekly subscription for coffee is obviously something that has been around for a while.
Yeah.
So we can get into the actual roasting, and Sumi, we can talk about that. But what is original with Yes Please is that every week you are given a broadsheet zine that is a very high production value. There are real journalists writing stories that are real. You're not journalists. You're not in publishing. You're in coffee. And you're doing this on a weekly basis. And I got to say, as someone who does content for a living and done it for a while, it's incredibly ambitious. And your execution is really good. So nice job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the setup. But like, really, like, what the F were you thinking about doing a weekly like newspaper?
Yeah, well, we sort of felt like weekly was the right cadence for just kind of putting coffee in people's hands, that if you sort of think about from a like culinary perspective, that having a gap of more than a few weeks between batches doesn't really let you iterate mm-hmm. as well. So a week felt like a good cadence for that. A week in terms of freshness in people's kitchen, it felt like if we were doing this every week, we'd be able to kind of fit into everybody's pattern, whether people need coffee, you know, a bag every week, a bag every 2 weeks, bag every 3 weeks, we'd be adaptable to that. So that was a natural. And then, you know, we knew we wanted kind of a newsletter or zine, and we started to figure out the physical dimensions of that first and kind of build our packaging concept around that. But once we had ideas for the first few issues and we started talking word count, mm-hmm. it was like, oh, wait, this thing is going to have to get bigger.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to change our packaging to kind of fit with the scope of the zine. And so
the trim size, was it actually changing the way you were packaging your coffee?
Yeah, yeah. It was in sort of the weight of it. So we started to look at newsprint and doing stuff on web printing and realized like, okay, that brings the weight and the cost down, so we can get a little more ambitious and kind of what our editorial budget can be for each issue. And we brought on Amy Marie Slocum, who was at Flaunt Magazine and is a fantastic editor, and she's been our partner in getting all of this up and running, and she works harder than any of us pulling this off.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for her, we couldn't do this. I mean, we're coffee guys, you know? We're like two degenerates who just like landed in front of a coffee roaster. But she's really the ace when it comes to the magazine.
Well, I think it's a really cool collaboration, and really each issue has a theme. It's not like you're just doing like Yes Please Weekly with a bunch of random ongoing features. You have to rethink the theme every issue, which we do issues ourselves at Taste, and it's challenging to like fill a page of content around a theme. So how are you coming about these themes, and what are some of the themes that you've covered with the journal?
Yeah, well, so every Monday morning we do an editorial meeting where we sort of discuss the next few issues and throw out ideas for issues beyond that. And it can start with just a small spark. Issue two was basically about criminal justice reform, and it revolved around I follow Scott Heschinger on Twitter, who's a public defender in Brooklyn, who's been doing a lot of stuff with the ACLU, is really outspoken. And he was articulating things at the forefront of all of these kind of interesting social justice movements. And I thought, okay, that's someone who I would like to read about in a magazine. And and I'm not seeing, you know, outside of like his growing Twitter presence that, you know, that anyone was kind of stopping and sitting down and talking to this guy about, you know, where do you come from with this? How did you find yourself in this position? And so it was more like, this is something that's interesting to me. And I think, and you probably experienced this too, like being a journalist or having a magazine gives you this license to interrogate reality and ask sort of bigger, more serious questions than you can do in normal day-to-day.
It's an absolute
quotidian.
Self-serving endeavor of being a journalist. You learn every single day, and you get to ask questions that you never would as a general civilian.
Yeah, you get to cross all these boundaries. Yeah. And so so that was like, well, why not do a whole issue around, you know, themes of criminal justice reform and what's going on in prisons? And it was easy once we sort of picked that to find three or four more subjects that kind of made sense to include under that banner. And when you send really good photographers out to photograph people, no one says no to being shot by like Daniel Dorsa.
I know. And it has like there's definitely like a level of when high production value, there's like a gravity to the conversation when you have like that, when you have like something to show them, like a weekly product.
Absolutely. And also just the things that you get out of people when you sort of take them seriously, take their work, their art seriously, they open up in ways that I think, you know, if they were just writing themselves and their own voice, they might not.
But you write openly about Yes Please being an experiment. Like, this was not something that necessarily you thought maybe in the long term would work. This very ambitious editorial ambition to go along with the weekly roasting, right?
Yeah, I think the first experiment was, can we even pull this off? Like, is it going to work? And we figured it'll take us 3 months to see if we can make it work without falling on our face. And we're 3 months in, and we've gotten every issue to press on time.
Oh my gosh.
Right. I mean, but you know, kind of the nature of this being, we're like in perpetual launch, right? Every week we're launching a new issue, a new iteration of the mix. And it's like, it might not work. We could get 6 months in and then suddenly the well is dry and we don't know what to do. So,
or we're exhausted.
Yeah, we could get tired quickly. But I think it's going well. I mean, it's weird.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of, on the team, I'm kind of like, I'm not well read. I don't really necessarily enjoy reading, you know. So for me, the approach of the zine and being part of our publication, I think I have kind of a different perspective on it. Like, I've come to enjoy it in a way that, like, I don't have nostalgia for reading newspapers or enjoying something to read with my coffee.
A lot of people don't have that nostalgia of the weekly zine.
Right. I think it's a very, like, I'm Gen X, and I think that, like, we you know, we came of age before the internet was fully baked. And so I think that sort of like, you know, 80s, 90s zine culture was a big part of kind of how a lot of us, you know, I grew up in rural Indiana. Mm-hmm. Sumi grew up in the Midwest. Like, mm-hmm.
As did I. Shout out all three of us, Midwest.
Oh, yeah.
Love it.
And I think like magazines play a huge role in giving you a sense of like what other things might be out there in the world for you.
And it's where the counterculture, to use a really generic term, but it means something, like where counterculture spoke. Like,
yeah.
And now that was Tumblr. Now Tumblr's kind of dead, but it's like Twitter. And like, it's obviously social media is where counterculture speaks. But before, it was like in print.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the internet has some limitations there.
Sure.
that the little small corners get stepped on or overcrowded or, you know, filled with trolls. And
oh God. Yeah, right.
I feel like there's, you know, a thirst out there for an alternative. And I think you see there's a lot of kind of boutique scale, very high end looking, expensive mm-hmm. magazines that have launched.
Yeah.
We're actually priced a lot cheaper than those, foolishly, but
you get coffee with it too.
Yes.
How about that? We're talking about only print, where there's these high end coffee zines, but they don't give you anything with it.
Right. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So I mean, it's our you know, maybe we save journalism by combining it with a useful.
You joke,
like
but
coffee.
It's such a smart, and your instincts are so on point. You need, for journalism to survive, it needs to be packaged with other things.
Right.
So you want to say something too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the experiment has proven to become an interesting place of discovery for me. Right, like it's nostalgic for Tony and maybe Amy, and like they're infinitely more brilliant and well-read and smarter than I am. But like, but like, it's great because I get to learn about things or read about things, yeah. Or we start to explore topics for the zine, and it's suddenly like I'm in the rabbit hole. You know, I'm in for this. You know, inmates training dogs. Like,
yeah,
I'm deep. So it's been a nice place for discovery.
What are some of the themes, Tony? That you've had in your 3 month run. So 3 months, that's how many issues is that?
Yeah, we're so
12 issues. I mean,
issue 15 comes out tomorrow, and that's on sort of dating in the digital age.
Yeah.
We started that one off. We were originally going to do just kind of a general romance issue and time it for Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. And it just ended up getting shuffled in our calendar. And,
yeah.
And then I spoke to Nancy Jo Sales from Vanity Fair, who had done an HBO documentary based on her Vanity Fair article about kind of the state of the apps and digital dating and how teenagers are dealing with Tinder and Bumble. And it was this sort of dark look at kind of what the gamification of dating is doing to young people. And so we reached out to her, and her and Amy spoke, and that mm-hmm. became the centerpiece interview, and we built an issue around that.
I love this style because it has interview as like kind of an anchor, which I think is sometimes lost in online media, where interview, the Q&A is kind of dead. I mean, some places you can find online, but you really leaned into the Q&A.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the new digital media is built around kind of freelancers or people who rightfully are trying to make a name for themselves as writers. And an interview doesn't really, I think, give a writer an opportunity to mm-hmm. kind of rationalize, like it doing a profile where you don't let the people speak for themselves and kind of put your own voice in it is better for your brand as a writer than just asking questions and transcribing an interview. So I think, yeah, maybe there's a trend away from.
No, it's nice. I think the New York Times magazine now has David Marchese is doing long form interviews previously at New York Magazine. So there is a little bit of a resurgence of the Q&A style. But I like that you are picking subjects and people who maybe aren't celebrities, but you're going longer with the Q&As. It's very smart.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it would be great if we, you know, interviewed some celebrity that would give us a tremendous amount of press and new customers. And, you know, I wouldn't say no to that. But I think it's more that, you know, I mean, as people who hang out and have worked in coffee shops for mm-hmm. years, it's, you meet so many interesting people.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the people that are in front of you or behind you in line at the coffee shop or the grocery store. There's stories there, and working in the service industry, you start to learn some things about people. Mm-hmm. It's like there's, you know, everywhere around you, there's amazing stories.
Let's talk about coffee, Sumi, because we've talked a bit about the journalism behind Yes Please, but I think you've taken a really unique approach to the subscription, because I'm finding a lot of subscriptions are single origin, but you're doing something different. You're calling it the mix, which is obviously taking a mix of coffees that you're roasting, but to work in concert with each other each week. So that's my perception of it as a subscriber. I've enjoyed many of your coffees, but talk about the process behind the mix.
Yeah, I mean, you've got it right. I tend to think of blending as like a mixing board, you know, and we're just manipulating levels of lows and highs and mids and just trying to get it right. And each song can sound different. Every time we get in the studio, it's a different session and a totally different feel. And, you know, we kind of came to the conclusion that we really believed that there's no single coffee on the face of this planet that couldn't be made better by blending it with other really good coffees. If we're really thoughtful in how we roast, mm-hmm. and intentional with how we're blending and care a lot, you know, and this is partly why we have one product, is because we could put all of our energy 7 days into one blend.
I'm going to do like the brake screeching sound, which I can't attempt, but like that statement right there is controversial, I feel, because I think a lot of roasting, a lot of coffee companies will focus on origin as being pure, and origin being like singular, single origin as being the way that they want to think about coffees.
And I think there's a place for that. Sure. And we did that for years too. You know, the focus on single origin has been like a big cornerstone of transparency and being respectful of the coffee and kind of building the following of specialty coffee. And I think we're at a point where we can still use those coffees and be respectful to them and be respectful to the people who are working hard to get them to us, but use them in a way that's different and, you know, combine them with other coffees that make them better than the sum of their parts. I got sick of drinking one coffee that, you know, is the same every day, day after day. And we find ourselves often at coffee bars drinking delicious coffees and thinking to ourselves like, wow, this is nice, but what if we added a little bit of Peru? Or, oh man, mm-hmm. this is just missing a little bit of this coffee. And it's like we've now hard-coded ourselves to think that way. But I think it's more of a function of logic than anything else. I don't think we're like revolutionaries. It's just, it makes sense.
Well, there's been blends that have always existed. Of course, a lot of the large coffee companies, like Hologram, is a blend, right?
Absolutely.
From counterculture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's nothing new about it. I think it's more just saying that, like, what if this is the front burner,
yes,
project? That there's kind of this, you know, Alice Waters, Shea Panisse, you know, here's the perfect carrot. You know, you want to taste the terroir. You want this clarity and transparency in what your experience is. And I mean, we love that. We embrace that. But I think, you know, once you've established that that's something you can do, then, you know, why not sort of take your gloves off, get your hands dirty and
work it
and play with it.
It's kind of like the difference between Italian and French. Like Italy is like all about the beautiful tomato, all about like a plate in the sun of like with basil and mozzarella and tomato. And then you got France, which is like, let's cook the shit out of something. Let's make an ugly potato into a beautiful thing. Let's add a lot of butter. Let's add some thyme. I just see this comparison.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is like embracing technique and not feeling like I think the trend among coffee professionals has been to tiptoe around these things and be very delicate about how we even talk about coffee, how we handle coffee, and for good reasons, but I think it's a little bit of an overcorrection that we've become puritanical about things and more concerned with expressing something intrinsic about each coffee than with like how it actually tastes or how people are experiencing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally right. I mean, we think about it as every week we're building a new dish, right? So we go to our farmer's market, which in our case is our Rolodex of really great importers and partners and producers, and, you know, people like Ryan Brown, who's our green coffee advisor. You know, we get to reach into his Rolodex as well. And every week we see what's available, we build a dish, we publish the dish, and then we throw the menu away and we start over.
And so the mix is changing every week.
Every single week.
And I'd like to talk right now about the economics between single origin and mix, because I think the mix is clearly some advantages. You can charge less for this coffee because it is using a variety of sources. That's my perception.
Theoretically, I think that's kind of everybody's assumption. But in terms of what we're paying for green coffee, that hasn't been the case. I think we kind of went through this with the coffee program for local, that everyone assumed, like, okay, they're doing a blend and there must be some corners that they're cutting to get the coffee this cheap. And it's really, no, it's just that we're only doing one thing and we're trying to do it at volume and we're eliminating waste. We're not doing a whole offering list, and that gives us some advantages for controlling the costs that don't involve cutting corners on what we pay for the raw material.
Yeah, I'm glad you cleared that up, because I feel like that is the perception in the industry, that when you blend, it's cheaper, but you're not. But you've clearly thought about price a lot with both your initiative with local and also with the price point of Yes Please, which is very affordable for what you're offering. So talk a little bit about the cost structure for Yes Please, and then maybe a little bit more about local.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're still trying to figure out the cost structure. We intentionally crippled ourselves on margins a little bit because with my previous startup, Tonks Coffee, we had some venture backing. We saw that there was this huge sort of untapped opportunity for a company that really focused first on the home consumer. And we had to have a certain margin to be able to spend money to acquire customers and kind of get on the treadmill of you know, paid growth and sort of your traditional direct consumer marketing stuff that everybody's doing, and
pump a lot of money into Facebook.
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, there's kind of a moral issue for us that there's kind of a moral issue for us where giving, you know, you look at all these direct to consumer brands that everybody's familiar with, you know, from your Dollar Shave Club or different shoe companies or whatever, and they're all giving a huge percentage of their top line revenue to Mark Zuckerberg and to Google to exist. And we thought, well, okay, well, if we price ourselves in a place where, like, that's really not something that's going to work for us, and we're just going to live and die by the quality of the product, by making our customers happy, and by word of mouth, and by making interesting content that lets us kind of expand our audience by actually doing things that are legitimately interesting to them.
That is the way to grow. Content is going to grow this audience, and coffee is going to grow this audience. It's not going to be an ad shoved in your face.
Right.
Love that. Also, I like, if you look closely in the credits, you have like your Instagram account, you have your Twitter account, and then the Facebook, it's like Never Facebook or We Quit
right,
Facebook.
Delete Facebook.
Facebook is your brand. I love that about it. You're like straight up being super transparent, like Facebook is not our friend.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also, it's you know, there's the moral case for it, but then there's also the amount of energy that it takes to be on that hamster wheel is excessive.
Sumi, I wanted to talk to you about coffee in terms of, how do we know when coffee is good and how do we know when coffee is not good? This is a question we grapple with the taste coffee issue and have always talked about, because I think there's a lot of variables in play when you're talking about quality, you're talking about roasting techniques, you're talking about home brewing techniques. There's lots of variables that kind of can throw things off. But how do we think about this?
This is a good question. I think it would be easy to go into the rabbit hole on this. So I'll try to do my best to articulate what I'm trying to say, but for me it's an easy question. I think the person who's living with a bag of coffee in their kitchen and having it day after day or couple days every couple weeks, you know, or starting the bag and finishing the bag, those are our real experts, and we're guilty. We've participated in this crime of not building enough on ramps for people to be enthusiastic about coffee. You know, we've kind of put up borders and walls and told them, like, we're the experts, trust us. And I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think if something tastes good to you, then it's probably good. And it doesn't need, you don't need an education or a, you know, certified letter from a barista to tell you that you're doing it right. I mean, just change out the beans. And if you like the result, then you're probably using better beans.
My issue with that, I think it's super on point. I think there are a lot of, it is a rabbit hole. We can't answer this now, but my main question is about the technique at home as a home brewer and the idea of, like, many people don't have a technique. They don't have a digital scale. They don't have a proper setup and they're making coffee differently every week. So how do I know if something is super diluted and is not diluted in like a, in an automatic machine, or if you're with a Chemex, you know, you're over extracting, like, how do you grapple with that?
Right. Well, I think that that's part of why we try to be really give empowering messages to our customers and let them know that they can reach out to us and get advice. And you sort of meet people where they are. So if someone has, you know, a blade grinder and a cheap Mr. Coffee machine, you can kind of express to them a little bit, like, how to figure out, like, what a good ratio of how much coffee you should be using and how to use the grinder. And it's not so much about, like, they can make a perfect cup tomorrow, but can they make a cup tomorrow that's significantly better than the cup they made yesterday? And that's the delta. If you can get people to make an improvement that's big enough that they notice it, and then they feel empowered, like, okay, you're taking the next step on a path towards better and better.
Really well said. Are you going to use the weekly Yes Please platform to talk about coffee? Because it's noticeable that coffee education is not really what you're trying to do right now in these early months of the zine.
Yeah, we've started with the next issue. There's going to be a coffee column in every issue that's going to jump around to a bunch of different topics. So we can talk about, like, we're doing an issue soon that's about sort of culture and fermentation. We're going to talk to Kwang from Baru as our cover story. And so that's an opportunity for us to kind of talk about fermentation and coffee and how that affects flavor and give people a grasp of that. But I wanted to kind of break the fourth wall here and say that, to Sumi's point, there's you're unique among journalists and in stepping into this coffee universe and
with some armor.
Yeah. but that's the thing, is you feel that you need to be armored. And I feel like when you look at any other culinary pursuit that you step into, you're very confident about your opinion. But we've created the situation where we're even food journalists, you know, the great Jonathan Gold, like all of these people who write eloquently about every other part of the culinary landscape, when they talk about coffee, they're afraid to say the wrong thing, the way that, like, I would be about wine. Or
you brought up a really great cognate and parallel, the wine journalism community, because I think it's similar, but also it's not, because way more people drink coffee and live coffee, so we want to write about it more as journalists. And thank you for acknowledging that, because I think there is like a third rail element about coffee and food writing, and a lot of people avoid it, or people will
or they've come in and we've pushed them out, that they hit a wall where they feel like they've talked to everybody they can, they've explored the landscape, they've heard from all the experts, and at the end of the day they still don't feel that they have an educated enough palate to say if a coffee is shit or shinola.
Right. And we think our customers know what shit from shinola. I mean, I really think I could serve my mother two cups of coffee, one very low grade commodity coffee, instant coffee, and something nice, and she'd be able to tell me this is better.
Yeah, Peter Giuliano who's a longtime coffee thinker, great spokesperson for what's been happening in coffee. Peter has this line, I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, most people can do the Pepsi challenge. They can taste the difference between Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola side by side. Like, it's a noticeable difference. The difference between even the most subtly similar single origin coffees is a bigger delta than the difference between Pepsi and Coke. No one needs to have an educated palate to be able to taste coffee or beer or wine. Mm-hmm. It's the jargon, it's the language, it's the sort of taxonomies around it.
The taxonomies is a key part, because I think coffee comes in many different ways to the end user. There's filtered coffee, there's espresso, there's cold brew, there's instant, there's from the cart, there's from the K-cup. You know, you've got all these different ways the end user. With wine, it's like pouring a liquid into a bottle with a label, and that's it.
Yeah, but also with wine, So with wine, you're dealing with a product that if I drink the same wine that you had 6 months ago, and you were in New York, I was in Los Angeles, we could have a conversation about that wine, and both know that we're talking about the same experience, the same product.
It's right there.
With coffee, it's so ephemeral, it's so slippery that, you know, I could say, hey, I just had this Guatemala from Stumptown, you should try it. And you go next week and you buy a bag of it, you brew it in a different way, you have a different experience. It was a different guy working at the roastery that day who did that batch. And we don't know if we're talking about the same coffee anymore.
Said better than me. Exactly. That's the biggest challenge about trying to write and talk and think about coffee from my point of view.
Right. And so then writers are prone to grab onto these kind of second and third order signifiers about, like, you know, they talk about the espresso machines or the amount of money that was spent on brewing equipment or the architecture of the space. And you kind of get all of this window dressing being part of how people are supposed to tell the difference between good coffee and bad coffee, and not just reinforcing the idea that, no, people should trust their own palate. Like, you might have paid $6 for that cup, but if you don't like it, it's probably because it's not very good.
Yeah, we try to lean into that. We try to lean into the fact that coffee is ephemeral and that your experience is going to be different than my experience. And, you know, a lot of times we're tasting coffees right out of the roaster, super fresh, in the cupping lab, you know, kind of a controlled environment. So when we sit down and write the label, or, you know, I start to write the copy for what the coffee, the label that's on the coffee bag, I intentionally don't want to tell you what you're going to taste. I want to be transparent and let you know what my intentions were and give you a general sense of what this blend is going to be like and what coffees are used, and have fun with that and be playful with that. But I don't think I should tell you what you taste. The real question I want to know is, do you enjoy
it? You like it?
It.
I wanted to come back and talk about local, because, you know, local, talking about experiments, seemed like a bit of a failed experiment, but a noble experiment. And I don't want to really get into the politics of the company, but I do want to talk about when local launched, it was very clear that they wanted to work with a reputable coffee roaster and make a $2 cup of coffee. Is that two?
We did it for $1.
$1. Yeah. Sorry, I knew it was a lower than average, but this is $1 cup of coffee. I just like to hear a little bit about that challenge of creating a $1 cup of coffee. Was it a challenge, and your general experiences with local?
I think it was a challenge, but really the, you know, to lift the curtain on kind of how we pulled that off to the degree that we pulled it off, I think it was Sumi had been figuring out his own cold brew recipe for a while, and sort of crack the code that ended up making it work.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of multiple parts. The first part was, let's put the coffee brewing stuff in the kitchen. Like, this is a cook's job. They can taste, they can prepare. There's no reason for us to hire a barista or pay someone dedicated to just babysit coffee. That was part of it. And the other part was, we had no waste. In the entire time that local existed, there wasn't a single bean or a single ounce that was thrown away. And part of the way we were able to do that, part of how we were able to do that was the cold coffee recipe was partially a cold brew concentrate, but brewed in a way that was cut with hot coffee that had been chilled. So we from the beginning wanted to create the menu to self-serve itself, so we would never have any waste.
It would always recycle. It was almost like it was like a sourdough recipe. It kept recycling.
Yeah. Absolutely. So yeah, it's kind of like a mother, situation.
And because there was no sodas on the menu, it meant that, to our surprise and delight, everybody was ordering cold coffee drinks all afternoon. So
the only caffeinated beverage was called cold coffee.
Right. And so that was a huge hit. And Sumi and Roy worked to make this sweet and creamy version of it that people dug.
Yeah, we made this sweet and creamy version of the cold coffee, which was kind of inspired by Cafe Dolce and Little Tokyo. They have a dulce latte, and it's just like this sweetened condensed milk, delicious. So we riffed on that, made our own version of that, Roy and I. And yeah, that was the menu.
And what's the future of this $1 cup of coffee? Because Local now is not really operating. Again, we won't get into the future of Local, but I want to know, is this idea still alive?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would say the idea of Local is still alive. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I think Roy and Daniel haven't given up on finding a path to kind of keep that in the world. I think Dollar Coffee, we got a lot of press around it. It generated some controversy inside of the coffee industry. I think in a good way, because it kind of made people question some of their assumptions about the context for good coffee, the audience. And again, like, you know, is it wrong to give somebody something that's that good, that delicious, that ethically sourced, that well roasted, that sort of cared for a dollar, when, you know, the rest of the industry and, you know, and really us and our own coffee backgrounds have been trying to push the price in the other direction for very good, legitimate reasons. And I think that, you know, when you look at kind of a croissant or, you know, anything that's like a pleasurable culinary experience, I think the price and quality don't, it's not a one-to-one relationship. There's very different contexts and economies of scale. Mm-hmm. And, so I think, I don't know if anyone else could or should do it. I think most, you know, fast food restaurants or quick service restaurants, beverages are where they make a lot of money. So to have something where, you know, your margins are kind of that tight is not wise. I wouldn't recommend anyone else try it.
Yeah.
But I think for the way that they were approaching the menu, and, you know, when they first sat down with us and kind of gave us the challenge, like, do you think that this could work? I being, you know, evidently not so good at math, said, yeah, but, you know, you'd probably have to be roasting it yourself and, you know, get really vertical with it and, you know, and reach a certain scale.
Last question. I wanted to talk about the idea of the subscription, because I think it's really smart. It's clearly the future for a lot of commerce in journalism. Where New York Times is a great example. Like, journalism is kind of going the subscription route, but also with food, with like the meal kits still being viable. And then with coffee, of course, you know, it's part of coffee, you know, the life of coffee. I mean, the world of coffee is revolves around subscription. So, like, how are you going to innovate with subscriptions, and what is the future of Yes Please in general?
Well, I mean, I'm not super bullish on subscription coffee, to be honest. I think when Tonks Coffee was kind of the leader in the space, I still felt we were a very small business. It was still nascent. And, you know, over the years, I've heard, you know, the figures for a lot of other third wave shops, subscription programs, and none of these are like a breakout success. Like, they're not on the scale of other direct to consumer subscription products at all. I think that coffee is a drug. No one is running out of their fix. People are, if you're addicted to heroin, you're not going to forget to pick up heroin on your way home. It's not solving a huge problem to get coffee into people's hands, especially now where there's, you know, grocers are starting to stock better coffee. It's a different landscape now. So I don't think we're, you know, we're curing polio by by putting coffee in people's mailboxes. So I think for us, it's, you know, can we do this at a more boutique scale and make it work with that, and not necessarily have to have the ambitions of being the category killer in some huge market.
The honesty there, because it's rare for a startup to actually have that kind of honesty about not trying to scale.
Yeah, and I see other people who I think there is a huge opportunity out there. I've just not seen anyone crack it, and I'm watching other companies raise a tremendous amount of money and hire people and try to build out these teams to tackle the opportunity. And I think it's a bet that, you know, we're fortunate. We've stepped on many of the rakes already. We kind of know the cheat codes, so. We have an unfair advantage, and I think it lets us take risks in other places that are more interesting to us than clearly. Risking it all on, you know, hiring somebody for a six-figure salary to sit there and tweak the Facebook algorithm all day to try to find new customers.
We're so into Facebook. I love it. And Sumi, where do you want to be in 2 years from now? With Yes Please.
I hope in everyone's kitchen. But I mean, like Tony said, we're bootstrapped on purpose. You know, we get to be militant because that's a smart thing to do for our business. And we are allowed to have a relationship with our customers because of that. So if you write in, it's Tony or I who are going to respond to you. That's it. We have a few people on our team, and we get to be small and talk to everyone. I hope that we could grow our team and, you know, pay people really great wages and have a small and scrappy team that does this at a much larger scale.
Are you going to sell boxes in stores, retail?
Yeah, tomorrow is our first day of kind of a beta test of that. So we have about 7 stores that we're sort of testing the packaging. And it's an unusual product, so I think, you know, it requires some hand-holding or explanation for people to understand what it is the first time they see it. And we'd like to roll it out nationally.
But you nailed the name from a haze, and the coffee's dope, so congrats.
Thank you.
And I wish you all extreme luck. I'm a huge fan and a paid subscriber, and I will continue. I think I might be upping it to maybe weekly. I might do it.
We're okay with that.
Cool.
Okay
with that.
Very okay with that.
Tony and Sumi, thank you for joining the Taste Podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Taste Podcast is hosted by Matt Rodbard and me, Anna Heasel. The show is produced by Gabrielle Lewis, studio recordings by Pat Stango, theme music by Steve Rydell. Interviews are recorded live at Books Are Magic in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn, and at Penguin Random House Studios in Manhattan. Visit Taste online at tastecooking.com. Thanks for listening.